Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Hello, participating in today's webinar, reflecting on key revisions to the uniform guidance. My name is Kyle Crow, and I'm an audit manager here at GRF. Today, we're also joined by my colleagues, John McIntosh and Mac Lillard. John is a partner in our audit department, and Mac is a senior manager in our risk and advisory services department. The three of us have a wealth of experience and knowledge in dealing with uniform guidance standards, so we have a lot of great stuff to share with you today. Participants seeking CPE credit today must complete and submit a short survey that will appear automatically following the webinar. To obtain CPE, please participate in each of the polling questions throughout the session, as that will be how we gauge your active participation. Please note that this webinar is not intended as financial or legal advice. This is simply for educational purposes only. We are GRF CPAs and Advisors based out of Bethesda, Maryland, serving clients in the DMV as well as nationally and internationally. Our firm services a wide range of clients covering not-for-profit, for-profit, government contractors, and others. However, our particular niche is within the not-for-profit and INGO space. We've been in operation for several decades, and next year we will be celebrating our 45th year anniversary. As you can see here, we have a lot of exciting content to cover today. So without further ado, let's get into it. I'll now turn it over to John to cover today's topics.
Thank you, Kyle, and good morning, everyone. My name is John McIntosh. Today, our main topic is the 2024 updates to the uniform guidance that took effect last year. Just in case anybody here is new and is not completely familiar with the uniform guidance and single audits, we're going to start by kind of having a brief overview of what that entails. Then we're going to kind of get into the revisions that took effect themselves. And that will kind of be a reiteration of the webinar that Mac and I did last fall. And then we're going to have some case studies that kind of walk us through some specific scenarios to help us understand. And then Mac's going to go over the cyber security considerations that are part of the updates. So starting by going over a quick overview of the uniform guidance, it's important to understand what that is before we discuss what's been changed about it. The uniform guidance really refers to the rules for federal grant management laid out by the Code of Federal Regulations, whereas a single audit refers to the type of audit that federal award recipients require when their annual expenditures exceed the single audit threshold, which was $750,000 before the update. It's called a single audit as it is one audit that includes multiple components. Those different components include an audit of the financial statements of the organization, including the schedule of expenditures of federal awards, as well as an audit of the terms and conditions of the federal award agreements themselves. So the uniform guidance, again, it's a set of regulations that provides the government-wide framework for grants management. Its official title is the 2 CFR Part 200, Uniform Administrative Requirements, Cost Principles, and Audit Requirements of Federal Awards. That's a very long title, so usually people just kind of shorten that to the Uniform Guidance or the UG. And it was originally issued by the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, in December 2013 and became effective in 2014. And it was really made to consolidate and streamline all the previous OMB circulars into one document. And housed in one place. Who does the guidance really apply to? Well, it applies to recipients of all U.S. federal awards, including nonprofit organizations, local governments, institutions of higher education, and tribal governments. And the goal of the uniform guidance is just to standardize how non-federal entities have managed their awards, making the process more efficient, transparent, and accountable. And you can always access the guidance for free at any time by visiting ecfr.gov. That's the electronic version. It always has the most up-to-date information, so it's the one that we always recommend that you use. Now, the guidance is broken down into six separate components or subparts. It's important to understand each one. The first one, subpart A, is the acronyms and definitions. This one is really a list of key terms that are frequently used in the guidance, sort of like a glossary. Subpart B is the general provisions. This part establishes the uniform administrative requirements and contracting policies that the federal agencies use to, in order to issue the awards. Subpart C is the federal award requirements, the pre-federal award requirements. And subpart D, the post-federal award requirements, and subpart E, cost principles, are really the two most important sections for the recipients of the awards to understand. D focuses on the recipient's administrative and logistical requirements, while E is used in determining the allowability of costs incurred that can be charged to the awards. And finally, subpart F, the audit requirements, that's our favorite one, of course. And this section kind of dictates when and how an auditor must conduct an audit of a award recipient, including, when that's applicable, how it's done, and how the auditor must choose the major programs from the SEPA that are subject to audit. Now, again, it's important to remember these six subparts since the revisions that took effect last year have an impact on each and every one of them. And that will take us to our first polling question.
Thanks, John. As you said, this brings us to the first polling question. Is your organization already required to comply with the uniform guidance? Yes, no, unsure, or NA.
We'll allow everyone a few seconds to submit their questions. As a reminder, the polling questions are required if you are looking to earn CPE credit. So it looks like about 65% of people said yes. So that's good news to hear. So now that we've got a solid understanding of what the guidance is, what the subparts that make it up are, we can kind of get into what the revisions were that took effect last year. So what changed? And just sort of for some context, the OMB periodically reviews the guidance and is required to issue updates every 5 years at a minimum. Since 2024 was the 10th anniversary of the guidance, this marked the second round of official revisions. So back on April 4th of 2024, they issued what was originally called the OMB Guidance for Grants and Agreements, and that document was later retitled the OMB Guidance for Federal Financial Assistance, which is the title of the document that's the revisions that we're speaking about today. And this second round was really considered to be the biggest update to the uniform guidance since its original release. And the revisions were really designed to modernize the guidance and make some much needed changes. They started by issuing a pre-publication version of this, which you can find still at cfo.gov or just by Googling the 2024 CFR revisions. And the cfo.gov version includes a red line version that shows what the original guidance was versus the changes that have been made. So if you want to compare them side by side, the current version at the ECFR I mentioned earlier, that one is up to date with the current revisions with no red line changes. Now, the revisions are about 450 pages long, so we'll kind of do our best here to summarize it today. One important takeaway is what was the key goals of these revisions? First, it was to improve the oversight and accountability of the recipients, align with national priorities, and originally to increase access to funding for various organizations, or at least that was the original intention. Everyone knows that there were some changes to that earlier this year, but nonetheless, that was the original intentions. So what are the effective date of these revisions? The effective date was officially October 1, 2024, so really just a few months ago, but there's some important nuances to the effective date that everybody should be aware of. For one, the effective date is specifically for awards that are issued on or after October 1, 2024. If you have any pre-existing awards, they would require a modification of the award from the donor to qualify for the revisions. So if you have awards that predated October 1, and you want them to be updated to the latest revisions, we definitely recommend that you contact your contracting officers and request those revisions if desired. And one tip that we're giving all of our clients that require a uniform guidance audit is to add a column on your CIFA that indicates if your revisions are applicable to each award or not. And that's important because different audit procedures will be applied depending on if those revisions are applicable or not. And we'll go into that during our case study in a little bit. And then one other exception to the effective date is that for subpart F or the audit requirements. And that's because audits are based on fiscal years, not points in time. So all of the revisions to the audit requirements are applicable for fiscal years beginning on or after October 1, 2024. So with that being said, the first fiscal year beginning on October 1 would have a year end of September 30th, 2025. So September 30th, 2025 would be the first fiscal year with the subpart F revisions in place. A couple of key changes in terminology. Throughout subparts A through E, they've replaced the term non-federal entity with the term recipient, and they've also changed the term grants and agreements with federal financial assistance. So everywhere that you saw those terms in the previous version, they've now been replaced with the new terms. So now we'll go through what the revisions are specifically by subpart. Starting with subpart A, the acronyms and definitions. So the revisions really made some key changes to these definitions that were aimed at improving the clarity and reflecting some more modern practices and some higher thresholds. That really starts with equipment. And generally, equipment is defined as tangible personal property with a useful life of more than 1 year and a per unit acquisition cost of $5,000 or more. At least that was the old threshold. They've now, with the changes, increased the equipment definitional threshold from $5,000 to $10,000. You are still allowed to use a lower threshold based on your organization's policy, but just remember that when it comes to pre-approvals for equipment, you need to follow your organization's threshold policy. So if you look for a lower threshold, you'll need to get your approvals at a lower threshold. The new definitions also provide some distinctions between equipment and supplies, especially if there's some items that could be considered to be either an equipment or a supply, depending on their value and use. Equipment, they've now kind of clarified as being durable, long-lasting, and above a capitalization threshold. And that's distinct from the supplies, which are generally consumed within a short period of time. There's also disposition reporting requirements that go with equipment that used to be $5,000 that they've increased to $10,000. And the same is now true for supplies. However, the difference is that the disposition threshold for equipment is based on the current fair value per unit value, where supplies are based on the total value of the supplies, not the per unit value of the supplies. So that kind of provides for a use it or lose it mentality for supplies and avoids any kind of stockpiling of supplies towards the end of a grant period of performance. They've also updated the definition of modified total direct costs, specifically related to subaward exclusions when applying an indirect rate. The definitional threshold for exclusions of subaward cost is now increased from $25,000 to $50,000 for each individual subaward. And that really means that a recipient can now recover more indirect cost on each individual subaward. And also one reminder about subawards that we'll be covering later is that a subaward is defined as a subrecipient that has programmatic decision-making capability. If they don't have a programmatic decision capability, then they will generally be classified as a subcontractor, in which case these exclusion rules do not apply. One other update they made for definitions is to the term question costs, to clarify what is question costs. And these are costs that would be disallowed by audit. That was previously defined as costs charged to a federal award that are not allowable under the relevant cost principles, that lack supporting documentation or appear unreasonable. And then the new revisions kind of provide some examples of what those could be and clarified the documentation standards and what could be considered disallowed. Subpart B on general provisions, the biggest updates here came to the mandatory disclosures clause. Previously, recipients were required to report violations of federal, violations of federal criminal law that involved fraud, bribery, or other significant violations of the law. And now the revisions have kind of lowered the reportability to whenever there is credible evidence that these existed. So it's now, easier or lower threshold for reporting these things. The revisions also provide more guidance on what constitutes a conflict of interest, to include organizational conflicts rather than individual conflicts. So for this one, the takeaway is that it's important to update your conflict of interest policy to cover board members rather than just employees. And it also provides additional flexibilities for languages other than English. There's now a clause on translation of critical documents that requires federal agencies to issue critical documents in more than just one language, so not just English anymore. For subpart B, these had, the biggest revisions here were related to streamlining the use of fixed cost or fixed amount awards. And just for some background and context, fixed cost awards are funding instruments where it's based on achieving specific milestones or deliverables rather than tracking detailed cost as you would with an assistance award. And these kind of awards are kind of more particularly useful for reducing administrative burdens. But what they did here was they really clarified that any unexpended funds over a fixed cost award may be retained by the recipient as long as the objectives and milestones have been met. It's important you don't refer to that as any kind of profit, but essentially that's what it would be if you didn't have costs that were up to the max of the award as long as you achieved the milestones. They also added clarity for fixed cost awards that these are not awards subject to audit, meaning that they would be excluded from your CFA since they're not tied to any kind of specific cost incurred. And they also have increased the maximum amount of a fixed cost subaward. Previously, you could not have subawards that were considered fixed costs that exceeded $250,000. The revisions now allow you to have those up to $500,000 with prior written approval from your agency. They also made some updates to Notice of Funding Opportunities, abbreviated NOFOs, and these are considered to be the sort of like the advertisements that federal agencies put out inviting an organization to submit funding proposals. These revisions really stress that the agency should ensure that they have clear direction to the applicants on what they need to submit. They emphasize the need for use of plain language and clear communication of the requirements, and they've also limited the length of the NOFOs and require a executive summary for these. So, makes it a little bit easier for applicants to know what they need to submit. Subpart D on the post audit or the post award requirements. Updates here mainly related to procurement and financial reports. They have modified the general procurement standard to remove certain geographic preferences. So that kind of, re reduces the area that you need to make certain procurements from physically, geographically. And then they also made some terminology updates to be more consistent with the FAR. For example, they changed the term small purchases to simplified acquisitions just to align terminology. And then, as far as financial reporting goes, they have changed the requirements for financial reporting that Federal agencies must only require OMB-approved government-wide data elements on their financial reports, and that financial reports cannot be required to be collected more frequently than quarterly. So this revision really kind of standardized how the federal agencies must require financial reporting, and makes it a little bit less confusing since some agencies had different requirements than others before. I know there's some comments in the question box. Once it's Mac's turn, I'll respond to any of those questions in the comment box. All right, one other thing for subpart D is the determination for subrecipient versus subcontractor that I talked about earlier. They really emphasized here that pass-through entities are responsible for the subrecipient versus subcontractor determination. And the emphasis here was just noted that you should have something in your policies that decides, what these are. And it's important that you have the correct determination on which is a subrecipient versus a subcontractor, as subrecipients are, subject to pre-award risk assessment and ongoing programmatic monitoring, while subcontractors are more subject to procurement procedures. And that takes us to our second polling question.
Thank you, John. This leads us to our second polling question. Which of the following would be considered an attribute of a subrecipient?
And that's A, that it has programmatic decision making and acts as an extension of the program, or B, complete specific tasks or milestones, or C, you're unsure. All right, looks like 77% of people selected correctly, and that's that a subrecipient attribute would be that it has a programmatic decision-making capability. All right, the next subpart is E on the cost principles. The biggest takeaway here is that they removed 9 items from the list of things that would require a prior approval. These 9 items include use of grant agreements, real property, equipment, direct costs, entertainment costs, membership, participant support costs, selling and marketing, taxes, including VAT. I think there was some discussion about potentially removing prior approval for foreign currency fluctuations, but that ultimately was retained. These removals kind of allow for more flexibility and autonomy in the management of the awards, but it's important to remember that all costs should be ultimately approved in the budgeting process, especially entertainment costs. And it has to, of course, relate to the project. Otherwise, it could be considered question cost at audit time or disallowed. Perhaps the biggest update to all the revisions is the increase of the de minimis cost rate from 10% to, quote, up to 15%. It's important to note that if a recipient has a NICRA or a negotiated indirect cost rate agreement in place, they cannot elect to use the de minimis rate. If you do, then you would need to get your NICRA rescinded by your cognizant agency. But it also did update some of the NICRA rules and states that all federal agencies must accept and honor a recipient's NICRA rate. And that's a big change since before some agencies had not recognized recipients' NICRAs and had imposed lower indirect rates within their agreements. And then the revisions also added clarification that a pass-through entity must similarly accept the NICRA rates of its subrecipients. All right, moving on to the changes for subpart F on the audit requirements. The biggest one here is that they have increased the threshold for single audit in major programs from what was previously $750,000 to $1 million. So organizations that had just previously been right above the audit threshold and required a single audit that might have spent $800,000 or $900,000, they may now not require a single audit if they have CFA expenditures under $1 million. And then the other change here is for the audit report submission. So, as has always been the case, single audit reports are required to be submitted to the Federal Audit Clearinghouse within 9 months of fiscal year end. And there was that was kind of a hard and fast rule. There was no exceptions. The guidance now allows recipients to receive extensions on that if received in writing by their cognizant agency. And you know, if that's in extreme cases, that would place undue burden on the auditee to meet the deadline. So there now is some flexibility with that as long as it's approved. Now, I know what you're thinking. All this is a lot to remember. It's a lot of details, and this was only a small fraction of the changes, but we're certainly here to help you at GRF. One thing that we've done recently is we have created a Federal Financial Assistance Resource Center on our website. It's a free feature available, and I've got a screenshot here of our website. You can access it on our on the resources panel dropdown, and then it's the bottom right link is the one for the Resource Center. And then here we have a screenshot of the Resource Center. It's got a lot of excellent information on this subject, including some of our pre-recorded webinars on the topic, some written articles that summarize the changes for you, blog posts on the cybersecurity considerations. And then the best part here is a printable checklist on how your organization can prepare for the changes. And I've got a yellow circle here on the link to that printable checklist for you all. And then this Resource Center also contains contact information for individuals at GRF that can help answer any questions that you might have. All right, as I mentioned earlier, we now have added some specific case studies here to learn some scenarios. Nathan, can you help me change the slide, please? It seems to be stuck. Or Mac or Kyle, if you all can change it.
Looks like I'm also stuck, John. Sorry.
I think they have some technical difficulties here. Here, let me, I can switch it now. All right, here we go. So our first case study is about a fictional organization called Hunger Fight. And Hunger Fight, in this example, expended $800,000 of federal awards during their fiscal year ended December 31st, 2024. In this example, they have an award from USDA that received a modification for the revisions after October 1, 2024. They also have several other awards on their CEFA that were not modified. Hunger Fight has historically used the 10% de minimis indirect rate for its federal awards, and they also have some pass-through entities included on their CEFA. So question one, is Hunger Fight subject to a single audit for the year ended December 31st, 2024? So in this circumstance, yes, they would still be subject to a uniform guidance audit since they, since as I mentioned, the first year that will be applicable to the new higher threshold would be fiscal years ended September 30th, 2025. Since this is before 2025, they're subject to the old threshold of 750, which they exceeded. Question two, is Hunger Fight subject to the revised uniform guidance for the year ended December 31st, 2024? So that one's kind of a trick question. The answer is yes and no. As they mentioned here, they had a USDA award that did receive the modification, but several other awards that did not. So in this case, only the USDA award would be applicable for the revisions. And that's why I mentioned earlier, it's important that on your CEFA, you detail which awards are applicable to the revisions and which ones are not. Question three, can Hunger Fight use the 15% de minimis rate for 2024? So as we saw in the example, historically they have used the de minimis rate. So they are allowed to use the higher rate when it becomes available. However, it's only available for the USDA award that was modified on or after the date. All of their other awards would still have to use the 10% rate, And of course, for the USDA award, the 15% rate would only be applicable to costs that were incurred after October 1, 2024. They would still have to apply 10% to costs that predated that date. All right, our next case study is about a fictional organization called Education First. This organization expended $900,000 of federal awards during their fiscal year end, which was June 30th, 2025. All of its federal awards were provided before October 1, 2024, and none of them received modifications after October 1. They also have used the de minimis rate historically, and they're considering updating their procurement policy to align with the revised uniform guidance. Question one, is HungerFight subject to a single audit for the year ended June 30th, 2025? Similarly to the first scenario, the answer would be yes, they are, because again, the higher threshold is only applicable beginning for years ended September 30th, 2025. Since this is a fiscal year that predates that, they are subject to the old 750 threshold, of which they expended 900, which exceeds that. Question two, does Education First need to change any internal controls or policies due to the revised uniform guidance for their fiscal year ended June 30th, 2025? The answer to this is no, because as they mentioned, all of their awards predated October 1, 2024, and none of them received modifications for the revisions on or after October 1. So they don't have to worry about updating their policies yet, but they should certainly start thinking about it. Question three, can Education First use the 15% de minimis rate for FY25? Again, similar question two, they cannot use it for 2025 since none of their awards were modified on or after October 1, so all of their awards fall under the old standards. And question four, can Education First go ahead and implement new procurement policies that align with the revised uniform guidance? This one is also a little bit tricky. The answer is maybe. None of the awards apply to the new uniform guidance. They can, of course, implement procurement policies that are more stringent than the old guidance, but I would be careful since actually the revisions sort of lighten up the procurement standards a little bit, I think, by removing geographic preferences and other things of that nature. So I would be careful, updating your policies to make them more lenient than the old standards if none of your awards apply to the new standards. All right, I think that takes us to the end of this section and on to our next polling question.
Thanks, Sean. This leads us to our polling question number three. What information technology slash cybersecurity framework does your organization file? Please check all that apply.
All right. Well, attendees go through and select an answer. We'll give everybody a minute or so to select one of these items. But just wanted to briefly introduce myself. My name's Mac Lillard. I'm a senior manager with GRF in the Risk and Advisory Services Department. So I focus on providing internal audit services to all of our clients, ranging from everything from IT and cybersecurity to financial controls to governance, operations, risk management, and all the like. I'm also a member of the IIA Washington, D.C. chapter, serving as a programs lead and incoming board member. And I'm also an AICPA CITP champion, or a certified information technology professional champion for the state of South Carolina. And I'll be talking to you all about some of the IT and cybersecurity considerations related to these new UG changes. So I'm looking at the polling results. It looks like 13 people answered other, and then we've kind of got a big mix of different frameworks that are followed. That's great to see. Identifying a framework is one of the first steps we'd recommend. We'll talk a little bit about that more. If you're other, or maybe not, I haven't identified a framework, No reason to sound the alarm bells yet, but we'll talk about some of the implications around choosing a framework or not choosing a framework and how that might relate to these new revisions. So with that, let's go ahead and jump into the slides. So here we just at a very high level are presenting these new changes. We're going to center the conversation around these three items. As we mentioned, we will be providing the slide deck after the presentation. So these little orange lines here that you can see are actual links you can click into within the ECFR system if you'd actually like to take a look at the detailed guidance as it is written. But in these next few slides, we're going to go over this at a high level and talk about some of the implications for any of your organizations or your clients. So let's go ahead and start with the first one, which is item 200.206B2. And this is related to federal awarding agencies' review of risk posed by applicants. So bullet number one here just talks about the fact that this is now a requirement for federal agencies to have a formal risk evaluation process, not a new concept for any of their federal award applications. However, it does require a specific evaluation of IT and cybersecurity risk, which is a newer concept. So under this new requirement, it's important to gain an understanding of the risk evaluation process for your awarding agency in terms of what they're going to be looking at, what kind of documentation they're going to be requesting to support their evaluation, and essentially what it's going to mean for you as the applicant or as the awardee in terms of your policies, procedures, controls, and things that you'll need to have in place in order to, one, be successful in winning an award or grant or contract, but also in properly administering that in accordance with the specifications or requirements of that awarding agency. This is something that we're really urging our clients to be proactive with in meeting with representatives from funding agencies that you're typically working with to just understand what the components of their risk evaluation process are going to be, specifically for those items related to IT and cybersecurity. Item number two here is probably the biggest area of concern for most people, just because when you actually take a look at the guidance, as with most government regulation, unfortunately, there is a lack of specificity in referring to cybersecurity or information technology requirements. As you can see here, this item in quotes just states management systems and standards, but that is inclusive of information systems and policies, procedures. So this section doesn't actually reference a specific framework. However, on the next slide, we'll note how section 200.303 actually does reference the standards for internal control in the federal government, as well as the COSO framework. Talk a little bit more about those on the next slide. But as I mentioned, it's always recommended as a best practice to identify a framework or a blend of frameworks that's most appropriate for your organization, based on your size and operating structure. So for example, a domestic organization that operates specifically within the US and does not have any international operations, they may choose to leverage NIST, CSF, or the National Institute for Standardization and Technology Cybersecurity Framework 2.0. If you're a government contractor, you're likely following that, as well as CMMC. There's also the Center for Internet Security and other frameworks, whereas an INGO or an organization that has international operations may choose to benchmark themselves or follow ISO, or the International Organization for Standardization, 27,100. So if you don't follow a specific framework, or if you can't support adherence through an independent evaluation, benchmark, or assessment, this isn't going to actually preclude you from successfully winning awards. But what it may result in is additional efforts to actually reduce the perceived risk associated with your organization's cyber posture, meaning that essentially you may be subject to more stringent monitoring and evaluation requirements over the life of that award. So for example, you know, an organization that submits proof of an independent valuation or benchmark or certification exercise stating that they are in compliance with ISO 27,100 and that it's performed by an independent third party, they may sufficiently address the cyber risk evaluation imposed by their funding agency and ultimately be assessed as low risk. Whereas an organization that can't submit proof of such an evaluation and doesn't necessarily follow a prescribed or a specific framework, they may then be assessed as higher risk and be required to fill out additional documentation or questionnaires, provide copies of policies, procedures, meet with risk assessors to walk through controls, and then over the life of the grant or the award may actually be subject to more reporting requirements or more stringent reviews. And just in relation to those monitoring and evaluation procedures, again, that all obviously comes at a cost in terms of time and effort. So it's always a useful exercise to understand, when you're trying to do your budget allocation and understand, when we should allocate funding or resources to shoring up our policies, procedures, or IT environment in advance of submitting a grant application. Is the cost there going to outweigh the additional cost or the additional level of effort to comply with more stringent reporting requirements? Or will we be better served by being proactive, shoring up all of our policies, procedures over our entire IT infrastructure that's ultimately going to benefit the entire organization, as well as our programs, and then hopefully reduce the level of effort or the resources we have to allocate towards monitoring and evaluation over the life of that award? So important to consider that cost benefit analysis as you're considering any of your IT investments moving forward. So jumping into section 200.303E, which talks specifically about internal controls. This is where I mentioned we're gonna the guidance does actually specifically reference standards for internal control in the federal government, as well as the COSO internal control integrated framework that I'm sure a lot of people are relatively familiar with. And the guidance can be very wordy and lengthy sometimes. So the too long didn't read version of that is essentially organizations should adhere to either of the above frameworks for evaluating and monitoring risks. Both of these frameworks have a few areas in common, a lot of it in common actually with specific nuances, but they really reference or emphasize the importance of formal policies and procedures to support the design of the infrastructure, as well as the controls at an entity-wide level, system and application level, and then diving into specific IT general controls or ITGCs like access rights, security management, configuration management, segregation of duties, and contingency or disaster recovery planning. So if you are following a prescribed framework like NIST or ISO, it's very likely that you are also in some shape or form following COSO. So it might be helpful if you are following one of these other frameworks to actually do some sort of mapping exercise to show how your existing practices or how compliance with NIST or ISO satisfies all of the requirements under COSO, and tying these out to these five control components or just ISO or COSO components that we see kind of on the front-facing side of this cube. And to just break these down in more detail and provide some context, we'll just start by going down these different areas one by one. So we start out with the control environment, which sets the tone for the organization and influences the control consciousness of its people. Think tone at the top for executive management. So in the context of IT and cybersecurity, this is going to include your governance structure. So making sure that there's clear roles and responsibilities related to IT security management. So who's responsible at the senior management or executive level, what the board's responsibility is. If you have an IT steering committee who evaluates and approves any kind of significant investments or initiatives, this is also going to cover your policies, procedures, making sure that you have detailed policies, procedures to support your IT and cyber protocol. And then this is just at a very general or high level, going to focus on ethics and integrity or a tone at the top. So making sure that your organization as a whole, not just in IT and cybersecurity, is fostering a culture of security awareness, ethical behavior, and integrity, reporting of any kind of suspicious or unusual activity. Then moving on down the cube here, we have our risk assessment process, which is going to involve how your organization identifies and analyzes risks that could impact the achievement of objectives. And again, best practice to say you should have this at an enterprise level or enterprise risk management, and then also specifically for over your IT and cybersecurity environment and controls. So this risk assessment may consist of your threat identification process. So how you identify potential internal and external threats, whether that be malware, ransomware, phishing, or insider threats due to inappropriate segregation of duties. This could also include your vulnerability assessment process as to how you analyze potential weaknesses in your IT infrastructure that could be exploited by attackers, and just your general risk analysis. So what is the cadence or what is the frequency that you're doing a detailed risk assessment to identify all of these risks and then actually quantifying them based on the impact and likelihood of these risks in order to help prioritize and then mitigate them effectively. Then we end up with our control activities, which are the actual activities and control mechanisms you have implemented today, or your existing control activities that help to ensure you meet the objectives of your IT strategy. So this will include anything and everything from access controls, change management, disaster recovery, training, everything that you have in place to support good data hygiene and cybersecurity practices. Then we move on down to information and communication. So, how are you communicating the importance of all of your IT and cybersecurity initiatives, what the expectations are for all of your employees and subrecipients, and just the overall communication strategy for relevant information and how this flows throughout your organization. So this can focus on data integrity, ensuring that the information used in decision making, whether that be financial, operational, IT specific, how you verify that that is accurate and complete, how what is being communicated to you is timely and secured. Incident reporting, so establishing clear channels for reporting security incidents and breaches, which will help you in responding quickly and effectively, and then also communicating the results of any kind of breach or unusual activity. And then your training and awareness. So, providing your ongoing training for employees on IT policies, what the expectations are for them, security best practices, and then recognizing cyber threats. And then lastly, we have our monitoring activities. And these help to ensure the ongoing effectiveness of controls. So, how periodically are you going in and actually testing controls to make sure they're operating effectively? Are you doing any sort of continuous monitoring, which might be using tools or processes to continuously assess the effectiveness of security controls and monitor your network? Are you doing any sort of internal audit procedures on a periodic basis to perform regular audits over your IT systems and controls? And do you have any kind of performance metrics identified, whether those be key performance indicators, KPIs, or key risk indicators, KRIs? So, do you have those metrics defined, and do you have the appropriate systems in place to aggregate the data and actually evaluate those on a periodic basis? And then this last section, I'm sure, was probably some welcome news from most of the audience, because this covers our direct costs. And I know this is probably small and a little tough to read, but with these new considerations, cybersecurity and IT costs can actually be charged as direct expenses to the grant. So ideally, this is going to help all of you in defraying some of that increased cost related to your information technology and cybersecurity initiatives. So previously, these costs were generally treated as indirect costs, added into the indirect cost bucket, allocated to programs based on maybe your 10 or now 15% de minimis rate or your NICRO negotiated indirect cost agreement. So in short, again, now you're able to actually charge some of these as direct costs. But it's important to note that these direct costs, need to follow the same procedures as any of your other allowable costs. So these need to be incorporated and specifically called out within your grant budgets, discussed with the donor or funder in advance to ensure that these costs are allowable based on the program's operations and the nature of these costs, and then obviously supported by the appropriate documentation in the form of contracts, agreements, invoices for services, and everything else that you should be familiar with at this point for any of your other expenses or direct costs under your grant. So to support the direct costs, again, important to have that included in your budget. And as part of that budget, it should ultimately be reflective of the organization's total cost for security. That way, when questioned on it, your allocation methodology will be supported by the overall organization-wide expenses as well as the business justification for incurring that expense. So just for a very high level and simplified example, generally speaking, organizations are typically going to spend around maybe 5 to 20% of their operating budget on IT and cybersecurity. And that's a pretty large range. 5% is kind of the general run-of-the-mill allocation that we would expect. But depending on your organization, if you are a government contractor and you're required to be CMMC compliant, or if as part of your program operations, you handle a large amount of sensitive data or personally identifiable information and you are at a heightened risk for attack, or just, if a breach would create a significant liability or significant impact to your operations, you may spend more than the average organization. And if the entire purpose of your business is to handle or store data or sensitive information or PII, then it's likely you may be up closer to that 20%. But for this example, let's just pretend we have around 5% of our annual budget. So if you have a $10 million annual budget with about 5% being spent on IT and cybersecurity, you've got an overall budget of $500,000. So if you've got a $1 million grant or about 10% of your overall budget, you could expect around $50,000 to be reasonably charged to that grant. And I know that is probably very oversimplified. There's lots that goes into your calculations for your direct costs and your indirect costs. But again, whatever your organization's breakdown looks like, this information should be incorporated into the grant budget, supported by data and metrics or historical activity related to the organization at large, and ultimately the underlying documentation to support any of the transactions and payments. So that was just a quick overview of the new changes themselves, and I wanted to just go through a summary of some best practices and some tools and references that we've included here before we jump into our Q&A. So just at a very quick overview, item one here talks about cybersecurity policies. This is really important and an area we see some organizations struggle with, making sure that it is comprehensive and that it addresses all of the key IT general controls identified under COSO, ISO, or NIST. So we provided two links here. One is to the SANS information security policies and one to the ISACA policy toolkit. Both of these are great. The SANS policies are free for any user. There's a very comprehensive library. They do require, I think, a little bit more customization and tailoring to your organization. And there's a lot in there. So it's necessary for you to kind of sift through what you need and don't need and make sure that you're just using the policies that are actually relevant to your infrastructure. I would say, in my opinion, the ISACA toolkit is a little bit more robust. I like the policies and the level of detail they go into a little bit more. However, they don't have as many policies as the SANS, and they also do cost $50 to purchase unless you have an ISACA member on staff. So again, maybe even using a blend of these two resources would be most appropriate for your organization, but both of these should give you a really good starting point. Item two talks about monitoring your subrecipients because ultimately they're going to be held to the same standards that you hold your own organization as it relates to protecting and securing their data and information that they hold or that they collect on behalf of your programmatic activities. So it's important to communicate this information to them, what these new changes mean, and what, as far as additional evaluation in your risk assessment or your ongoing monitoring and reporting, how this is going to trickle down and what requirements are going to be pushed down to them and what their expectations are for complying with these new cybersecurity rules. So we've also included a link to a guide to third-party risk management. It does focus on vendors as well. It's not necessarily specifically tailored to subrecipients, but a lot of or all of the practices or tools or references in there can be applied to your subrecipients as well. Item three talks about cybersecurity risk assessments. So performing a risk assessment or a vulnerability assessment, and this can be done periodically or as item four references, it can be done as a continuous process. So we provided a link to a tool that we use called the Open Source Threat Intelligence Scan. And this is going to scan all of the publicly available facing assets. So not something that you need permission to run on a client or a third party or on a subrecipient, something that you can run to just get a high-level risk assessment and a nice, easy-to-read scorecard over their infrastructure. So this could be applied to your subrecipients, could also be applied to your own organization to just evaluate your cybersecurity posture on an ongoing basis. We provided some examples as well of some of the different vendors, some of which you are probably relatively familiar with. Black Kite is the tool that we use. CrowdStrike is another one. Y'all probably remember the CrowdStrike cyber breach that happened a couple of years ago at this point. And I reference that just because it is important not to put all your eggs in one basket and make sure that you're relying on one vendor. It is good to have a full suite of services. And you can discuss all of these with your managed service provider, outside IT consultant, financial consultants, or your cyber insurance provider. I'm sure they'd be able to point you in the right direction of a suitable provider or solution. Item five talks about just strengthening your internal controls for cybersecurity. So making sure that these align with the new federal guidelines. And a couple of items that we typically really hone in on because of the importance and just protecting your systems and data are enabling multi-factor authentication on all of your critical systems, and then providing periodic training. And periodic training is one of the big ones, primarily because it's one of the lowest cost but most highly impactful controls that you can implement. Most articles or publications you'll read will include some statistic related to the fact that phishing campaigns or social engineering are the primary way that an outside actor gets access to your systems and causes a cybersecurity breach. I believe it's somewhere around 40 to 50% of all cyber breaches are a result of phishing or social engineering. So providing your employees with adequate training and the information they need to secure their systems and your organization's data is extremely impactful and just beneficial from a cyber standpoint. So we work with a vendor called KnowBefore. They're an industry leader. They have a whole suite of different trainings and a library of resources, as well as phishing simulations, which we highly recommend to actually test your employees' understanding and their ability to identify red flags. Hook Security is another one similar to KnowBefore. I think it's a little bit cheaper as far as a per user basis, a little less on the library of resources and trainings available, but they do allow you to, I think, customize or tailor phishing simulations directly to your organization and your operation. So a little bit more flexibility there. And then Barracuda and Mimecast are two very popular email filtering or spam filtering service providers, and they have now moved into the phishing simulation because they see so many of these, and their primary service area is to actually prevent these from even hitting your inbox. They also have very robust and difficult trainings or phishing simulations that they can administer on your behalf. You should also have an incident response as well as a disaster recovery plan in the worst case event of a scenario or a cyber breach, having that process defined so that you can respond quickly and effectively to mitigate any of the impact and secure your data before anything is exfiltrated or you become liable to any kind of fines or penalties. So we've got a resource here that just provides some information on that as well. Number seven talks about allocating resources for your cybersecurity investments, given all of these changes, given the change in the risk environment and your organization's infrastructure. It's important to understand about how much you should be spending on IT and cybersecurity, what that, what is going to be the right fit for you, and how much you need to be investing into these new initiatives. And the last item is just a general best practice. This doesn't necessarily address any of the new changes, but we always recommend that our clients obtain some level of cyber insurance to help cover costs like legal fees or investigation fees, business disruption that could result from a worst case scenario like a breach or ransomware or malware. One of the other benefits of cyber insurance is that they'll actually typically provide you with other resources, maybe even like periodic scanning, cybersecurity training, or just a library of resources, because they're actually incentivized for you to have a strengthened cybersecurity posture. Obviously, if you have well-trained employees and you're doing periodic scanning, it's less likely that you're going to suffer a breach, which means it's less likely that they're going to have to pay out on the insurance policy. So they are incentivized to help you in shoring up your policies, procedures, and your cybersecurity environment. So lots of different secondary benefits beyond just the overall insurance coverage. But with that, I think that wraps it up for my section. So I just wanted to thank everybody for coming today. I know we unfortunately didn't leave too much time for questions and answers, but please feel free to use the chat function or the Q&A to put anything in or ask any questions of John or myself or Kyle. Also, please feel free to reach out to us on LinkedIn or email us directly after to keep the conversation going or ask any of the remaining questions that maybe you didn't get the chance to touch on today. But otherwise, if there are no questions, I just wanted to thank everybody for being here with us today and encourage you all to reach out if there's any lingering questions, comments, concerns.
All right. Thank you, Mac. With that, we'd like to thank everyone for attending today's discussion. We encourage you to follow us on social media at GRFCPAs and visit our website for upcoming events and alerts. Please remember to complete the survey that will appear automatically following this session if you would like to earn CPE credit. Thanks again and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.